with his delegation from the Health Department. Let me also take this opportunity to welcome also our support staff that is here to give assistance to the committee. Minister, the committee would have loved to receive the presentation at least 2 days before the meeting so that we can familiarize ourselves with the contents of the presentation, because it's a little bit difficult for us to, as you present, to try and follow everything. Otherwise, we miss other important issues when we do so. So, yeah, I hope that, I know that you normally send us documents on time, and I hope that we'll still continue that approach to send us your presentation. And with those few remarks, can I take this opportunity to allow the minister, as the agenda dictates before us, that we hand over to the department to lead the briefing for today. Thanks very much, Minister.
Thanks, Ron, for your remarks, and good morning to everybody. I do hear that you say we usually got a presentation 2 days or a day before we come to the actual meeting, but we don't have the presentation even now. So how are we going to listen or to respond to anything that we need to respond to without
the hard copy?
Can somebody keep my copy in the meeting? Why don't we be doing production so that I understand you are speaking me?
Okay, yeah. You're quite right, yeah. Member Mnuma, do you still want to say something?
No.
Yeah, okay.
What do you want then?
All right. Yeah, let's start with introduction. Let me start with the department to do its introduction before we come to the members.
Department staff, thank you.
Good morning, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members and Minister. Dr. Yogan Tare from the National Department of Health, responsible for the TV panel.
I'm Kofi Mokali. I'm a consultant for the Department of Health.
I'm Dr. Susan Lukeka, and I'm a public health prevention advisor in the National Department of Health.
A consultant is not what you know. In medicine, he is the most senior
doctor.
It's now confusing things because it's just personal. If you are the most senior doctor, sort of a professor in a hospital, you are called a consultant. Because the other one below you is doing a senior degree, a register. From there is a medical officer, then the most junior is an intern. So that's what he's talking about.
And you have to choose that description.
What?
The consultant one.
Well, I was confused when I arrived in government, when they call anybody a consultant, because where I came from, before you become a consultant, you must really pass.
Yeah.
It's you guys in politics, not us.
So we would be the
okay, thanks for the introduction.
Okay.
Yeah, no.
Good morning. My name is Sipho Plaki. I'm a member of the Select Committee. I'm representing the province.
Good morning. My name is Willem Faber. I'm a member of this select committee, and I represent the Northern Cape province. Thank you very much.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Michael de Villiers, and I'm also a member of the select committee, and I'm representing the Western Cape.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Lydia Mshuli. I'm coming from the Free State. I'm the member of the State Committee. And
good morning, everybody. My name is Pinky Mwabe from Gauteng. I'm a member of the Select Committee. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Zuki Swaranto
from Eastern Cape. I'm an acting whip of the self self-deployed acting whip in this company.
That's not allowed. No more in the house, man, the chairperson of the committee. Support that.
I'm Sean Whiting. I'm the researcher for the Select Committee on Social Services.
Good morning. Mirella O'Reilly, Acting Registrar and CEO, the Health Professions Council of South Africa.
Thank you, Chairperson. I really promise this won't happen again. You know, sometimes when you move from Pretoria to here, the planes, the times, and all that, you do get disorganized, but we're promising won't be disorganized again like this. Chairperson, I was asked to speak about three issues: the public sector strike, the overview, the issue of child mortality as it pertains to three hospitals, the findings and the action, and the issue of medical meal circumcision and progress. Can you help me there? Yes. Chairperson, let's start with the public sector strike. Is there a point that Johannes Samuel? Can you go and get a pointer for me? Yeah. Well, it was a very unfortunate thing to have happened to our country. What was most heartbreaking was the lack of concern for patients, which I really regard as a new phenomenon in our country. We have got reports per province with some examples which are province specific. We were managing the strike both nationally and provincially. We had daily meetings in the Joint Operations Center and Provincial Operations Centers. In addition, the National Department of Health, the DG and all the DDGs held daily teleconferences with provinces so as to inform us what should happen, what happened that day and what should happen the following day. We were also able to get some court interdicts making the strike illegal. They were granted in KZN and in Gauteng. Our intention at all times was to try and keep all health facilities open and functional. But in some provinces, non-emergency surgery was put on hold. Non-emergency surgery means elective surgery where people just get booked for surgery and you can always postpone it and do it whenever you have got time. But we need to thank SAPS and South African Health Military Health Services. We achieved to keep facilities open because of them. During the strike, initially large hospitals were targeted. Like I'm sure you say a lot of about Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital. It was targeted more than any other hospital in the country because almost there were stories that they really wanted to close it. But I must tell you that that was never successful. It was one of the hospitals that functioned better, contrary to Belize, because I once worked there, I actually saw. But we decided after realizing that to secure this hospital, like Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital, and then, so the strike has started targeting smaller facilities, usually in groups. And they were winning because quite a number of them in these small groups were coming as if they are just ordinary patients. But once they arrive inside the facility, then all hell breaks loose. Both patients and staff were highly intimidated. And the impact of the strike was highly variable. In other words, it was not very clear on any one day because it was shifting all the time. But managers were requested to keep registered to identify strikers to implement cabinet decisions regarding no work, no pay rule. But in some instances, the strikers attacked the administration center so that no registers could be kept. And make it very difficult to know who was on at work or not, and also that some quite a number of people claim that they've been there but they ran away only because of intimidation, so it becomes very difficult. Contrary to popular belief, no doctor was ever on strike. I want to emphasize this because when we check the newspapers, you know, articles and especially commentaries by newspapers and cartoons and all that, it was as if our doctors were on strike. There was no doctor in the country who was ever on strike throughout the whole country. Most of the strikers who were health workers were nurses. I'm not talking about cleaners and general staff. I'm talking about the professional staff. It was nurses. That was the biggest reason why services were affected, especially at hospitals, because where doctors wanted to do operations like scissors, you need a nurse. And in quite a number of cases, we got successful because some senior doctors acted as nurses under the circumstances, where you find a gynecologist doing a scissor and the other gynecologist becoming scrub nurses to help. It should also be noted that the biggest nursing organization, there are several, but the biggest of them is DINOSA. It did not call any strike. DINOSA never came out and said they are calling any strike. But when we met the most nurses who did not report for duty said no because of intimidation, not that their union called them over to go on strike. Volunteers were exceptionally useful in assisting with non-clinical services, members of the community. This was the positive part of the strike, while the negative part was the first sentence about disregard for patients generally. But when called over to come and volunteer, quite a number of people came in laundry services, cleaning, cooking, feeding patients, washing them. It was something that was marvelous for our country. The distribution of drugs and blood, as well as lab services, was largely secured because South African police services were able to escort services where required. So in this case, we never had problems in acquiring blood, getting laboratory tests done, etc., because SEPS was very good in that. In the province of Western Cape, less than 1% of strike was ever on strike, except on day two when it was 2%. That was the highest. So by and large, Western Cape was unaffected by this strike. In the Northern Cape, day one of the strike saw 268 personnel absent, but this reduced to less than 10. From day six of the strike. So the Northern Cape also was very much largely stable. In the Eastern Cape, referral hospitals like Nelson Mandela Academic, St. Elizabeth Frontier, Free Clinica, Cecilia Makiwane, PE Provincial, Doran Ginza, and Livingstone were kept functional at all times during the strike. These were hospitals where everybody was referring to. In Eastern Cape, a number of district hospitals, as mentioned there, that's the list there, were non-functional at times, but with management intervention, core functions were maintained during the duration of the strike. What we'll do, Chairperson, when we realize that things are bad, is to make sure that at least core and emergency functions, like labor ward and casualty, are functioning, and we make sure that the others, like OPD, where people are coming for, you know, chronic illnesses, are the ones that are affected, but at least the basic services are allowed to function. Dr. Ari and Alfred Nzo reported 100% functionality at clinics in some hospitals throughout the strike, whilst in Amatole, Roa, Tambo, and Nelson Mandela, many clinics and hospitals were affected. KwaZulu-Natal, Itegwini was the worst hit region. As I said, they tend to target the biggest hospital. As you know, in KZN, the biggest hospital is King Albert VIII. That's where most of the people, targets were. So 300 patients who were surgical and in ICU had to be referred to the private sector because at one stage, 46,000 staff members were absent during the strike. So KwaZulu-Natal was also heavy. Hospital most affected, as I said, was King Edward VIII, where the intimidation was very strong, where health workers were being physically removed from hospitals. There were no nurses at Mahatma Gandhi. Patients were moved to Osindiswene. Intimidation at Prince Micheni, like a car of a staff member was burned and one nurse was assaulted. Well, can you move? As I said, hospitals were variably affected and it was very difficult because things change. You can report something in the morning. In the afternoon is different because the strikers were moving from one area to the other. And some of the nurses really, I must say, contrary to belief, were very helpful. Whenever they had any chance, they would sneak in and help. I must mention a very emotional situation in Bara, especially in the trauma ward, where all the post-surgical and injured patients were, where one nurse told me that she was scared and at home. But when she remembered the number of corpses that would come out of that ward, she just couldn't stay at home. And she phoned her friends, SMS them, and they hired kumbis. And they went to work because she said, I did not regard this as numbers. I could even see the faces because I know them. That if I don't go to work tomorrow, so and so will be gone. So there were such emotional scenes where nurses who are attached to their patients were prepared to put their life on the line. But during the strike, we did not want to announce this type of things because what the strikers were doing, they were listening to news. If you say this hospital is stable, the following day, they are all there. So some of these things we had to keep confidential. Let's move. Gauteng had a very good method, which I think we'll learn for the future, which no other province was doing. They had coded their hospitals into three categories. Sorry. There was red, meaning drastically reduced services. Yellow, it means it remained open, functional in most areas with minimal staff. And green, it means it's functional with minimal interruption. So this type of coding was helping. Can we move? Yeah, this is how they were quoted. When they say Natal Street was red, Hillbrow, Lillian, Goy, oh yes, that spelling there is terrible. Shawela, Zola, Mofolo, it means there it was bad. But the middle one means services were being done. Unfortunately, as you can see, most of the huge hospitals in Gauteng belong to that yellow section. That's why we survived, because then all the other smaller hospitals referred to them. And the green ones were working, were functioning very well, but they are much smaller. Yes, as you see, Chris Hani Baragwanath has hospital there. It's in the yellow. If it was in the red section, we would have been in big, big trouble around Gauteng because almost everybody who is in trouble in the Gauteng area, particularly Soweto, their place of refuge is Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital. And also, call back, George Mukari there, as you know, the whole of Northwest, the whole of Limpopo, and the whole of Mpumalanga. When they refer to George Mukari. If there was big trouble there, we'll some of the province would have been, even without the strike, that's where people all go to. Next. We also tried from the National Department of Health. When I went to work at Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital and George Mukari, I took along 60 doctors, nurses, and pharmacists who are managers or workers in the National Department of Health. We took them to go down and work within the hospitals and make sure that services are on. Most hospitals, yes, when the army sealed Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital, it started to function very well, I must tell you, and that helped the whole of Gauteng, because most hospitals in Gauteng started referring to Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital, because they regarded it as a secured fortress. That's why at one stage in the labor was in Chris Hani Baragwanath, they usually performed 21 cesarean sections in 24 hours, but at one stage during the strike, they performed no less than 24 in half a day, in 12 hours, meaning the rate of seizure doubled, meaning that everybody was rushing there and they were able to handle that. In Limpopo, the hospitals that were mostly affected include the Listers and Ritas, Matara, Philadelphia, Kroblastal, and Jinfes, where entrances were barricaded. And that that, you know, during the very first day of the strike, we realized it when people were bringing food, were blocked from entering some of those hospitals there in Limpopo. Then we had to start finding emergency ways of providing patients with food. It was something that we regarded as extremely evil because it was clearly punishing patients who were sleeping there and not knowing what's happening outside. They just saw food not arriving, only to find that the people who were supplying food were blocked at the gate. That was before police came in.
Yes.
But as you see there, when South African military health services came in, because the doctor from the army who and nurses, when they are deployed to a hospital, they don't come alone. They come with other soldiers who are not necessarily doctors and nurses, but who come there to protect them. Then they seal the whole place and it starts functioning. Mpumalanga, as other provinces, were variously affected, as we've put there, but a total of 282 health personnel from South Africa Military Health Services were deployed to 11 hospitals in Mpumalanga. In other words, the problems in Mpumalanga were only in 11 hospitals, as I've put there, and that's where the 282 members of the Defense South African Military Health Service went to help. Most affected areas in the Free State were Bloemfontein, Belonomi, which is the biggest referral hospital. This is the hospital where a terrible incident happened last week, which you might have heard about. Northwest reported around 1,025 to 1,028 workers on strike daily. And hospitals most largely affected are the ones mentioned there. Well, the lessons we learned from the strike, I believe there was a shifting public side here in terms of our attitude as a nation to health facilities and health workers. I'm saying so because some of us are old enough to have participated in 1976 and saw what happened there, where health workers were largely respected. If you are a nurse, they just ask you to wear your white uniform, nobody will touch you. Perhaps we have got many young people who don't know that, because this was completely different, where actually nurses had to wear other clothes rather than their uniform, because wearing a nurse's uniform is becoming a sitting duck. That was in clear contradistinction to what happened in 76, where your uniform was a protection. This public side, we need to work very hard to bring it back into this country. We urge community leaders to mobilize communities to protect health workers and health facilities to ensure that we are able to provide uninterrupted services. This is really a call to everybody, regardless of what might have angered them. This is what I said during the strike, that there's no justification on targeting people who are sick, because I said even international practice during war, that's not allowed. Even where there's military conflict, we know that while the Red Cross Society comes and put the flag there, people will respect that. Otherwise, your country will never be respected internationally if they do something like that. In short, even war has got rules. You don't just go in and fight without rules. But this strike, people seem to have thrown rules out of the window, rules of humanity that distinguish humanity from any other species in the animal kingdom. But also, the strike reinforced something that I've been saying, and I want to repeat it. In South Africa, we are running a highly destructive, unsustainable, expensive, curative healthcare service, where patients wake up every day to go to a secondary or tertiary hospital as the first point of entry. This is not how to run a health service. You don't just wake up and start going to Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital. In a normal health service that is not described by destructive, unsustainable, expensive, curative, you start at primary health care level. I am saying so because in quite a number of hospitals, I realize that we are having a large number of patients who are not supposed to be studying there. So for this reason, because it actually appears on our 10-point program as number 4, the overhauling of the health care service, we need to reconstruct the primary health care movement with community involvement. And fortunately, we have just done that, the first part of that in terms of training last week, where we called all the MECs, all members of the Portfolio Committee on Health from all provinces and national, meaning parliament here was involved. We spent and we called people from many countries who are successfully running primary health care and national health insurance, like Brazil, Costa Rica, Mexico. We even called people from the Americas, the World Health Organization, etc. We spent 3 days in Durban, and we took a decision that the healthcare system in the country need to be reconstructed such that we have got primary health care. Primary health care means we have got community involvement and community health workers, right from the communities and families. By the time a person goes to a hospital or clinic, we have already got in contact with somebody who is a community health worker. This is not it's happening in South Africa, but it's done in an uncoordinated fashion. We have got 65,000 people in this country, 65,000, who are employed by health, social welfare, local government, and NGOs called by different names and are hired differently. Some are called community care workers. Some are called home-based care workers. Others are called DOT supporters for TB. Some are lay counselors for HIV/AIDS. There are about 9,000 of them. All of them are supposed to be serving the community. And many communities are complaining that we are confused. We no longer know who is who. This one comes and says, I come from this NGO, this one. So our meeting there then was to say, let's do one coordinated structure whereby we'll account for each and every person. If such a system was functional, for instance, many people who wanted to collect their treatment could not have bothered because community health workers will know them. They'll know that this one is diabetic, this one has got high blood pressure, and they can't get into a hospital because there's a strike. They'll go and collect medication for them. KwaZulu-Natal is very much nearer to this system because of their high prevalence of HIV/AIDS. They've brought all these groups together in what they call CADAs, and they work together. I was there last week. We went to visit some of the areas. It is the direction which the country needs to take. If we had that direction, the tribe would not have been that biting. Thank you, Chairperson. I'm not sure whether I must move to the next presentation.
I think you do the best to do so.
Yes. The issue of child mortality. Chairperson, I realize that everybody, because this was very dramatic, the death of babies in some of these hospitals happening at the same time. I realize that is my duty from where I'm sitting, because I know more than that, to inform the public, especially those who are leadership positions, that we should not take this as isolated incidences, because otherwise we'll miss the point. The fact that it happened in those three areas doesn't mean that it's something that is isolated. It can actually happen anywhere, because our country is going through a rough patch, a very serious rough patch, and I want leaders here to understand. Firstly, there are only 12 countries in the whole world that in the past decade, in the past 10 years, dismally failed to bring down infant mortality. That means bring down the number of children who die before they reach the age of 5. Only 12 countries in the whole world failed to do that, and unfortunately, South Africa is one of those countries. Our infant mortality started to rise disproportionately since the early 1990s, when the HIV/AIDS epidemic started. Annually, 70,000 children are born HIV positive in South Africa. The total figure for children who are born HIV positive in the whole continent is 400,000, and South Africa contributes 70,000 of that. In comparison, just to show you what the rest of the world is doing, in the past year in France, only 4 babies were born HIV positive, compared with our numbers. As you know, also maternal mortality has also been on the rise during the same corresponding period. And what people must know, infant survival and maternal mortality are closely linked. The survival of a mother who has just given birth and the survival of that baby are closely linked. When you have got the rising infant mortality and a rising maternal mortality, it will definitely affect infant survival. And that's the problem we're having. For that reason, I thought I'll take this opportunity just to show you some of the things I'm talking about, especially about HIV AIDS. I'll tell you why I'm linking it with this, because I think I'm taking this opportunity to give information. In 1990, when you look at women who were pregnant, who were going to our antenatal clinic or maternity clinics, only 0.7% were positive. This figure started rising until we were there. Which means out of every three women in South Africa who attended our maternity clinics, on average, out of every three women, one is going to be found positive. Yeah. And this one shows that the positive, those who are HIV positive, are in the childbearing age. This is where women start bringing children into this world. That's where HIV AIDS is hitting us the most. That's where the issue of child survival becomes central. I just wanted people to understand, because you come from various provinces. The biggest ever problem is in KZN. As you know, red means danger. Yes. And yellow follows that, and then orange. It means here in the red areas, it's not the general population, are women who go. So it's not a study. It's actually the real thing. Women who go to our maternity clinics who are tested in different areas, more than 40% of them were found to be positive. And in this, I don't know what that color is. Mustard.
Yeah.
It's between 30 and 40. That one is between 20 and 30. Meaning, in all the districts of KwaZulu-Natal, there's no district where you find less than 20% positive among pregnant women. This is Mpumalanga. The red area is Kertsibanda, which is more than 40%. The others are between 20 and 30. No district in Mpumalanga is less than 20%. It's less than 30% actually. Between 30 and 40 years. This is the Free State, which in terms of overall prevalence is number three. I forgot the slide of the overall prevalence. Number one in overall prevalence is KZN. Number two is Mpumalanga. Number three is Free State. Then, oh yes, number three, unfortunately.
You have to work in this
program. Yes. And number four, I think, is Gauteng. This is the Free State, as you can see. Only this area where there are very few people is less than 30. The rest of the areas are between 20 and 30. This is Gauteng. And I'll tell you the significance of this when it comes to the issue of child survival. As you can see, the biggest problem Gauteng is Ekurhuleni, Johannesburg, and Sediveng. Areas like Tshwane and Motsweding and Westrand are much better. This is where the problem is concentrated in Gauteng. Next, this is Northwest. Bujanala and Kenneth Gaunda are the hardest hit in Northwest. These two areas. I'm sure this is around Rustenburg, this is around Kekstok, yes. This is Eastern Cape. As you can see, I'm going to use a word, but I'll explain it later because people don't understand why I say so. This we did not expect. Yes. We thought it would be higher. I'll tell you why later. But it actually gave us a reason for the next slide. This was completely unexpected. What I'm saying, you can see, is Eastern Cape is much, much better. When it's much, much better. The biggest problem is around there, which is next to KZN. These are the districts nearer to KZN. I will tell you why later, why I said we never expected this. Next, this is Limpopo, which is my home province, as you know. I also didn't expect that. I expected to be higher. Because, yes, not partly so, but I'll give you the reasons as we move. This is
the
Northern Cape. The only problem is around Kimberley, Francis Town, otherwise the rest of the area. But here there are few people, my friend, as you know. So you must understand that. Yes. One, people get overcrowded, HIV move from one person to the other. If there are fewer of you, yes. Next. But Western Cape is very safe, I must say. The only province around Cape Metro, the rest of Western Cape is much, much better. Next. Yes, this has reduced life expectancy in South Africa, as you can see. And it's a very serious issue for our country. This is life expectancy in Nigeria. I mean Algeria, female 72, male 70. This is Senegal, look at South Africa. In fact, there's an argument that this is too high, now gone worse than that, because this was 2006-07. The World Health Organization put life expectancy in South Africa at 47 years, actually. What happened? When did this actually happen and how? This slide gives the answer. You know, that this issue of life expectancy and death, it happened swiftly over an 8-year period. Just in 8 years, life changed drastically in our country. This is 1997. It shows the pattern of death from zero. That slide is not, you can't easily see. That is 0-4 years, 5-9, up to 85 years. From 0 years, from birth to 85 years. How was that? It shows that the peak of death was here in the 70s, etc. In 1998, 1999, 2000, it kept on shifting. By 2005, it has shifted so much that the peak of death was at 30 years. These are young women. So this shift happened between 1997 and 2005.
Where are we now?
We are still somewhere there. It's only that we ended in 2005.
But isn't it right much higher now?
We will release some of the studies later. Like the maps I've shown you were for 2008. The 2009 maps, I'm releasing them on this Thursday. And there are serious changes, unfortunately, because I'm releasing them officially in a press conference this Thursday, you see. This is female death between the age of 15 and 64. We just compare ourselves over the years with other countries. You see, this graph here is for Brazil. It shows that in 2004, the graph of death in Brazil from 15 to 64 was following this pattern, which we think is normal, meaning there's more, the peak of death is starting from 65. At 15 is very low. In South Africa in 1997, we were more or less like Brazil, but as you can see, we're starting to wobble. But just 7 years later in 2004, this is our graph, showing that now, by that time, by 2004, the number of people who were dying at 30 were as high as those who were dying at 65. Now, this graph is significant because Professor Makhoba, who is now the Vice Chancellor of the University of Natal, who was the President of the Medical Research Council, wrote in the article in the Medical Research Council that something is killing young women in South Africa at childbearing age, which is not in keeping with the laws of biology. You say HIV, AIDS, our studies are showing that young women are dying at childbearing age and is not following the laws of biology. What he meant is that in the biological system, in the animal kingdom, you don't find this type of graph. Which means if you go to Kruger National Park, start with butterflies and with elephants, draw a graph of how the female dies, it will show this. It won't show that, which means HIV is a completely distorted biology as we understand it. Unfortunately, that warning was not necessarily heeded. Now we see the results, the fruits of that. Next. This is a study from Lancet, which is very important. Many people say we over-exaggerate the HIV epidemic. This slide summarizes it. What the Lancet said, the Lancet is a very prestigious British medical journal. They never did the study. They commissioned it. The study was done by our own professors and researchers from UCT and all over the country. What they say is they found that South Africa is going through 4 pandemics. That means there are 4 clear patterns of disease which are heavy, which the country is going through. The first one is the pandemic of HIV, AIDS, and TB. In terms of this pandemic, South Africa forms only 0.7% of the world population. But we are killing 17% of HIV-positive people of the world compared to our population, 0.7 versus 17. Our HIV-AIDS average is 23 times the world average. Same thing, we are killing 5% of the people of the world suffering from TB. I'll show you later how bad is it. This is a pandemic. The second pandemic is maternal, newborn, and child health. That's why I'm saying the incidents we have shown are not isolated. We are going through a pandemic of mothers who die in pregnancy, because maternal mortality does not mean death of a woman. It means death of a woman because she died herself pregnant. And she was killed by a pregnancy-related cause. If you are pregnant, you get knocked by a car or by this man who has become evil and always assaulting women and killing them. That is not maternal mortality. Maternal mortality, you have to die by a pregnancy or pregnancy-related cause. So I want you to understand that. Newborn means before the age of one. There are those who die before the age of one. And child means before the age of five. So there's a difference between newborn and child. Defined in years, this will be called infant mortality. That's newborn. That will be called under five mortality. We are going through that pandemic. The third pandemic we are going through is non-communicable disease. Disease of lifestyle, that means diseases that are not caused by infection, like high blood pressure, diabetes mellitus, cardiac disease, and cancer. Now, in a way, they are also cruelly linked to that, and I'll tell you why. Most people, and studies have shown that, and we see that quite often, most women who are HIV positive will have cancer of the cervix of the uterus. It's on the rise. In fact, yesterday I was the biggest HIV center in the country, the best of them all is at Helen Joseph. I visited there, and I visited their area where they do pap smears, and they said 50% are abnormal pap smears. 50% of all women who are HIV positive, and they see 12% of all HIV positive people there per annum. 12% of HIV positive people in the country attend that clinic, and they said 50% of them have got abnormal pap smear, which means they are showing signs of developing cancer. We also know if you have got diabetes, your chances of catching TB are four times. We also know other cancers which were gone, which I only saw during school in textbooks, they are back now because of HIV AIDS. Even leprosy, we are seeing 70 cases of leprosy per annum. I'm sure many of you know leprosy from the Bible. The one in the Bible is the extreme one because there were no hospitals where people start falling out. You can see leprosy without your parts falling out because we see it very early. We see 70 of that. It was gone, but it's back. Because remember, leprosy and TB are very closely related. They are formed by more or less the same organism. The organisms have got the same name. They only define names. So they belong to the same family. So one TB is on the rise. You also see that they are all brought by HIV. The last pandemic is injury and violence. Everybody in South Africa speaks about this. STD is the biggest problem in our country. When they talk about people not coming to the World Cup, this was what they were scared about. Our biggest problem in the country is this and that and that. That is number four, the issue of injury and violence. Yes, now this slide is also, it makes you think. You won't be able to see, but I'll demonstrate it. These are 22 countries, starting with India, China, Indonesia, Nigeria, South Africa, etc. Ending with Afghanistan, there, Cambodia, Myanmar, etc., etc. These 22 countries, among themselves, they are carrying 80% of the TB of the world. As you can see, number one there is India, followed by China and Indonesia. We are number five. But this is misleading because these countries have got 30 times our population. Now, the best measure is to measure how many people get infected per unit population. And our unit population is 100,000. How many people get infected per 100,000 people? When you do that, South Africa is number one in these 22 countries. We have got more than 900 people infected per 100,000. Our distance number two is Zimbabwe, as you can see. There's quite a gap of 200 between us and Zimbabwe. But you can see that out of these 22 countries, which are carrying 80% of the TB of the world, five of the countries are within SADC, which means SADC is a hotbed of TB and HIV AIDS. The other statistic that is taking is this, what is called co-infection rate. Co-infection means people who are having both TB and HIV at the same time. As you can see there, in India it's 5.3%. In China, it's 1.9%. In South Africa, it's 73%. Our distant number two is against Zimbabwe at 69. It means 73% of people who have got TB are actually HIV positive, making TB and HIV one and the same disease. And in the country, we have got to treat them that. The simplest way to explain them is two sides of the same coin. If you go to hospital, you find a person with TB, assume HIV. If you find a person HIV positive, assume TB. In 73% of cases, you'll be right. Next. I just want to show this. If a woman is pregnant and negative, the chance of dying pregnancy will be 34 out of 100,000. But once women are positive, the chance of dying increases 10 times, as you can see. So HIV AIDS increases maternal mortality tenfold. Next. This is death, unfortunately. 1,600 mothers per annum. This is in both our public and private hospitals. We don't count those who die at home. According to the World Health Organization, as you'll see later, they put it at about 6,000. Now, we are suddenly having 20,000 stillbirths in South Africa. I'm trying to explain what we have seen in newspapers, which was put as an isolated thing. 20,000 stillbirths means children who are not born alive have now reached 20,000. Those who die before they reach the age of one, infant mortality, have now reached 22,000. Those who die before they reach the age of five have now reached 75,000 per annum. Now, this is a spectrum. If a child is born, it's a stillbirth, 20,000. It means others are born and die the following day or after a week. So what we have seen is just that it happens in one day in one hospital. But this thing is what we are faced with almost every day. Next. This is child mortality. You are aware that in September, I'm one of the people who went to the United Nations to report about the Millennium Development Goals. This is what we took there. What it shows is that in 1998, the number of children who were dying per thousand was this number. In 2001, it has drastically increased to that. By 2007, it has doubled. In terms of Millennium Development Goals, we are supposed to be here by 2015, but we are going in that direction. People are asking whether we'll reach our Millennium Development Goals. The question is, are we able to combat what causes this? The biggest contributor to this in our country is by far HIV and AIDS. Maternal mortality, the number of mothers who die in pregnancy. In 1998, the figure was here, 150 per 100,000. It went here in 2001. By 2007, it was there, meaning that we are having about 6,000 maternal deaths per annum. In terms of Millennium Development Goals, we are supposed to be here by 2015, but we're there. Next. This is from Stats South Africa. It shows that by 2007 already, 57% of children who died under the age of five were killed by HIV AIDS, meaning more than half of under five died because it's actually approaching 60%. This one is for babies. It shows that when a baby is HIV positive, they stand a 15 times chance of dying within the first 6 months of life. That means HIV AIDS increases the possibility of death in the first 6 months of life by 1,500%. I just compared two provinces, Mpumalanga and Western Cape, how life changed in South Africa. Between the age of 0 and 11 months, not even 1 year, how were babies dying in Mpumalanga? In 1998, look where it was. It was almost down to zero. That was only 1998. From there, it started rising until by 2006, it was here. The peak of death was at 3 months. Western Cape was worse than Mpumalanga in 1998 because it was here. By 2003, they reached a peak, they were there. But they started a massive prevention of mother-to-child transmission with nevirapine and dual therapy, and they went down by 2006. Meaning that if action is taken, things start happening. It wasn't your party, it was mine. Next. at that time. I just want to make that point clear.
But by now there's nothing.
Honorable Father, so you won't get any chance to ask any questions because you have exhausted the questions.
Unfortunately, Chairperson, death has doubled in South Africa within a period of 9 years. Between 1997 and 2006, death doubled. What do you mean? If you go to Home Affairs Death Register, by 1997, the total number of people dying in our country was 300,000. But 9 years later, it was 612,000. That's absolute doubling. No question about it. Next. Child death is in selected hospitals. I wanted to give you this background so that you don't look at events in isolation, because they seem to be a continuum of one another. Focus of death in Charles Matrek and Natal Street and in Gauteng and Eastern Cape in Tata. 10 babies, as you know, 6 babies died in Charles Matrek Academic Hospital. 11 died, the press said 10, but it was 11, in one day in Natal Street Hospital. We chose a committee consisting of these professors. These are well-known professors in the field of child health. And we chose very senior nurses to investigate what actually happened. The cause of death of these babies was an infection called norovirus. It's a gastrointestinal virus that is spread by contamination from hand, food, and materials. There was a lot of reports about Klebsiella, which is a very dangerous bacteria. Klebsiella was found in the feeding bottles, but none was isolated as a contributory cause of death. It means it was in the feeding bottles, but not necessarily in the body of the babies, but in the breast it was put as if that is the one that did the killing. The killing was done by norovirus. In the case of Natal Spray, the 11 children, the causes were variant, but because the way we report things, well, we have to, you know, people sometimes jump with excitement and all that. Out of those 11, 4 were macerated till birth. Macerated means they were dead more than 24 hours before the mother arrived in hospital. They arrived long before. And 5 of them were HIV positive, relating to the slides I've just shown you. Now, why is HIV positive so important to us? It causes overcrowding. That means the number of babies who cannot be discharged to go home have increased dramatically, especially in areas where I've shown you those maps. We are suddenly having preterm babies. Babies are now born, even at 600 grams. You know, a normal birth must be between 2.5 kilograms and 3.5 kilograms. We see babies at less than a kilogram. If they are 800 grams or a kilogram, we can try. But once they are 600 kilograms, it's just a matter, I mean, less than 600 grams, it's just a matter of time, and that's what is happening in our hospitals. Now, apart from the fact that they all survive because they are born too small, they cause overcrowding because usually a mother delivers 24 hours later, you send home. We are no longer able to send home. The mother stays there, and others find them there, there's overcrowding. When I went to Natal Street Hospital, that neonatal ward carries only 35 neonates, newborn babies. But when I was there, there were 75 of them, meaning more than double. So when the mothers come there to breastfeed, controlling an infection and all that, it just becomes a nightmare, and things which we used to deal with just get out of control, which is what happened at Natal Street, even at Charlotte Matage, because there was just massive overcrowding. The neonatal units were overcrowded. The nurse patient ratio was high due to the large number of babies. That means they just overwhelmed the nurses. Where you are able to put, when a baby is a preterm, you usually give 2 babies to a nurse for 24 hours. Now here you'll find that one nurse is taking care of 5 babies because they need real care. So they were overwhelmed. Adherence to general infection control and prevention controls was not satisfactory due to the overcrowding. The infection control went down because when you are in a neonatal ward, you need to obey certain rules and regulations. But both hospitals, after this disaster, extended their neonatal wards. In Natal Street, they put 10 extra beds, unfortunately. You know, we are building a new hospital for Natal Street, which is about to get completed. That will be a solution to our problem. And then in Charlotte Matrek, they increased by 30 new beds, giving them a total of 55. And they tried to hire 3 additional doctors, 4 professional nurses, 2 enrolled nurses, and 4 enrolled nursing assistants. They were appointed to the neonatal ward to try and help. Basic infection control methods were strengthened. You are aware that we are going to provide a bill on Office of Standard Compliance, where our hospitals must comply with certain standards. That bill is likely to come to Parliament early next year. We have chosen 6 standards. One of them is cleanliness. The other is safety and security of patients. The other is infection control measures. In other words, there will be standards which every hospital must obey all the time. In terms of the Office of Standard Compliance, there will be an inspectorate giving specially that job to go to any hospital and check the standards. Maybe let me just complete this, all 6 of them. Is safety, I mean, is cleanliness of the hospital, safety and security of patients, is infection control, attitude of staff, the long queues and drug stock outs. These 6 will make them basic standards, which in terms of the law, which you are going to pass, every health facility at all times must obey. Inspectors can come anytime, inspect them, you know, and write a report. We'll also establish an office of an UMBAS person where every patient can go and complain so that the person will in fact investigate whether it is the health worker or the hospital or is the system that has failed that people, because sometimes you can't differentiate. If you check the death of these babies, it was mostly the system than the health workers. People were itching for somebody's blood. The professors there and experts, when they investigate, they found that the health workers did everything that needs to be done, but the situation was just out of their control. So in both hospitals, monthly maternal morbidity and daily neonatal mortality review meetings are taking place. And then we bring the feeder institutions and we try to make them refer HIV-positive mothers very early. We are trying to network with communities, and this network will be helpful. If women come to the hospital with the baby already dead, simply means in the community there's no primary health care. And it becomes the problem with the hospital why the baby died. Meanwhile, the baby died long ago in the community, as it happens with the 4 deaths at Natal Street Hospital. A community death, not a hospital death. Next. Umtata. There were reports of 179 babies having died at Nelson Mandela Academic Hospital. We also established a team, a national team consisting of the professors I put there to investigate. And in summary, most of the problems there, as I said, were shortage of ambulances, lack of referral, you know, the poor roads where women who are in labor come to hospital very, very late, when it's already late on during labor because of lack of transport. We're trying to do that and to try to solve that problem. Next. We also established the need for interdisciplinary perinatal mortality committees. That means obstetrics, gynecology, and pediatrics, child health, that is. They need to sit together. The shortage of ambulance was noted, but we bought a lot of ambulances during the 2010 World Cup, which has relieved the situation. I'm sure many provinces bought 65 extra ambulances or so. Next. Yeah. The issue of medical male circumcision. We have got 9 strategies, Chairperson, of preventing HIV/AIDS, and I want leaders to know those strategies, because some only believe we only prevent HIV/AIDS by condoms. There are 9 strategies. One of them is information, education, and mass mobilization. Sexually transmitted infection, detection and management early. This one you know. We want you members of parliament to come and do it. Know your status, the HCT counseling and testing. We can't deal with HIV/AIDS when people don't know their status. This is one of the main ones where we want to test 15 million people. Then widespread provision of condoms, where we are increasing condoms from where they are. Next, medical male circumcision, which you called me here for. It's just one of them. Prevention of mother-to-child transmission. I want to stop those 70,000 children who are born HIV-positive, because no child needs to be born HIV-positive. Safe blood transfusion. This is the one we have won in the country. The chance of getting HIV AIDS from a blood transfusion is 1 in a million. it won't easily happen because the South African Blood Transfusion Service has opened a state-of-the-art facility in Rodeburg. If you get our blood from that service, unless you get blood from elsewhere, but it's from our service, the chance of getting HIV AIDS are quite slim now. Post-exposure prophylaxis, all women with the high incidence of rape, we have instructed all CEOs in hospitals, they must stop asking questions. When women go to hospital and say they have been raped, they are asked, you know, but are they special, you know? Whether you have been to a police station, whether you have reported the case, whether this is truly a rape, we have instructed them, please stop asking questions, treat, and ask questions later, because you have got only 72 hours to help this woman not to get HIV AIDS. You have got 72 hours. Then you also teach life school education. Now, medical male circumcision, studies have shown here in South Africa and in other countries, especially on the African continent, Uganda, one of them, Botswana, etc., that medical male circumcision reduces woman-to-male transmission by 50-60%. This is important as leaders to understand because people confuse it. I've seen newspapers writing very wrong stories about this medical male circumcision, how it affects. All we're saying is, if a male is circumcised, the chance of getting HIV AIDS reduces by 50-60% by getting it from a woman who is infected. So this only is a protection for men. Not all of them, but it does help. That's why I mentioned that story about Eastern Cape. We have no other evidence to explain why Eastern Cape and Limpopo are the way they are. And KwaZulu-Natal and Mpumalanga, Gauteng specifically, if you remember my maps, it's explained by the fact that you see in KZN for 200 years there's no circumcision taking place. And so it's all red. That's why King Zwelithini changed that. He changed it because of this, the realization of this, and now they are circumcising. And they are doing it more than anybody now, as you see. They are in the lead. I'll come to that. No. Yeah. Now, Limpopo, you also know there are three tribal groups. They also have the circumcision. In Mpumalanga, you saw the area that is red, the Skatsiban. These people are Zulu speaking, they also don't circumcise. The areas that are not red is in the Ndebele speaking mostly and Swati speaking, and they do circumcision. So we concluded that it actually supports these studies. That's why massive medical male circumcision is one of the weapons, part of that line. It's not only the only one, part of that. SANA plenary took a decision as a policy in July 2009, but KZN is the first province to come out openly because the king gave that instruction to all Amakos, called them to a meeting and said, now the 200-year tradition, we are dropping it. You must do circumcision, but he said you must do it as medical male circumcision. They call camps, but they call doctors. And the chairperson, they have decided to do, yes, they have decided to do 2.5 million circumcisions by 2015. And chairperson, out of that 2.5 million, 1,000 are going to be done by me as my contribution. I've already done three, I'm left with 997. I'm hoping to complete that 997 by 2015. These are the figures. Now, KwaZulu-Natal, as you can see, because they call camps, circumcision camps, I've attended those. These camps, I think, are very good because they don't just arrive there and circumcise, contrary to belief. They call Amakosi and elders, and they call HIV AIDS activists. They do HCT counseling and testing. Counsel these kids and test them before circumcision. Then call the elders, you know, cultural groups, to teach them about manhood, you know, problems of rape, violence against women and children, responsibility of men. It's really a school, a social school, more than just coming to cut, as people believe. The other provinces, people just had and started going to hospitals. That's why the figures are so low. In KZN, it's a program. The other provinces have been asked to budget for it. They will start it as a program next year. But the figures here were just people who had and say, oh, I understand they are circumcising, let me also go. Health facilities did not turn them away. But as you can see, KwaZulu-Natal is quite phenomenal. They are planning that by the end of the financial year, they must have reached 18. Next, the devices. I know that's what you called me here for. the issue of devices. Now, I want to explain, Chairperson, because there are many reports about this issue of devices. There are two ways to perform a medical male circumcision in the hospital. Medical, there are two. You do what you call a dorsal slit with a surgical method, which has been done for ages. Now, there are devices which perform that circumcision, and there are many. One of them is this paraclamp that is always in the newspapers. There are many. There's a belief which has gone by and is now believed widely because one report, just one report in the papers, it moves like hellfire. There's a belief that the World Health Organization approves devices. It doesn't. The World Health Organization doesn't approve any device. They've got no policy or no unit that says this device is approved. So when KwaZulu-Natal chose on their own, out of these many devices, they chose the paraclamp. As to how they've done it, why they chose that one out of many, that's not for me, but they decided to test them. Part of the reason being that, why not just stick to the dorsal slit? There's an issue of time here and expenses. If you use a dorsal slit, like I did the three circumcision, I will have taken about 1.5 hours, or at least 1 hour. But with a clamp, I will have clamped maybe 15 during that period. Because we just clamped, you know. So people around the world are trying to look for that method. And it's quite unfortunate that this thing causes war. And I want to tell you, as members of parliament, it's reminiscent to what brought us to the studies I've shown you. In South Africa, we like arguing people. We argue a lot. Mm-hmm. When people moved to do PMTCT with Neverapin, we started an argument, a debate, which ended in court. When people start circumcision, many of these countries started this circumcision long ago. We only started this year. The ambassadors of AIDS Free Society, which consists of former heads of state, headed by former president of Botswana, Festus Mogae, Kenneth Kaunda, Chisano, and you know, Bishop Tutu in South Africa, Judge Cameron, they formed that society. They moved from country to country advising people to undertake this medical male circumcision. In August last year, they asked me, you guys, what are you waiting for? Countries are doing that. We're still debating. Then we insisted SANAC must pass as a policy. When we start, we now debate about devices. This is very unfortunate in our country because I don't want us to get bogged down by these type of things. So what we did, we wrote to the World Health Organization to ask them. This war about device because people were saying they didn't approve. The World Health Organization responded by saying they don't approve devices, but they asked us that because your country has got such a high prevalence, maybe you are the ones who can help the world with research. Why don't you research it? They gave us a protocol that when you research, this is what we do. In that protocol, we put specialists and urologists especially. One of them, as he was introducing himself, that gentleman there is a urologist. They are the ones who specialize about circumcision. He's coming to help us about that. Now, we want them, I even invited those who are complaining. Among them, the TAC, the Clinician Society. I said, when the urologist make this investigation, be there to see whether we are doing the correct thing using the protocol. I was shocked to here, people are already fighting in the press. And instead of saying this device is working, we are even getting involved in issues of tender, in which I'm not getting involved. And I'm asking people, if it's a question of tender, why don't you deal with it with the legislation about tender? Because let me give you an example. The dorsal slit, we use scalpels, we use sutures, we use needles. If somebody procures them fraudulently, very fraudulently, are we going to start questioning them that no, this needle, because it was procured fraudulently, is not good? I'm trying to say, let's separate this. If the war that I'm hearing is about tenders, please deal with tenders. We have got the power to do so. I am dealing with the policy and the issue of doing a circumcision. But KwaZulu-Natal said, no, let's try the methods and see which is faster, which is cheaper, and eventually we'll choose. The other provinces have not yet done so. And this is about adverse events. What are the adverse events? Next. And, third person, I want you to understand me. I'm not defending anything. I'm defending a principle. Because I even saw my picture in one of the papers, and the headline there was about tender. I got very shocked. What do my picture was here? Then when you read, you know, I'm not sure why we do that. I want medical male circumcision. 2.5 million males by 2015. When you ask other provinces, it's a massive job. And I've been speaking to the premier of Mpumalanga and the MEC. Please start. The number of deaths in Herzegovina, we can no longer allow them in this country. So what King Zwelithini did, he called Amakhosi, and in that Wekweshama ceremony last year on the 16th, and His Majesty announced the revival of circumcision, which was gone for 200 years, to formulate strategies. And in January, there was this consultative meeting. MEC for Health was given a mandate to go on with this process. On the 10th of April, the King himself launched a campaign in Kwanongoma. And during that launching, 555 males were circumcised just in one weekend, and they were all sent home. Next. The benefit, as I said, is mobilizing people to know their status first, supporting people. I just want to correct something which I saw in one of the papers, where Dr. Zungu, the HOD, was reporting, and people thought, circumcision is finally a solution. Because he said 99% of the children who were circumcised were found to be negative. He didn't mean they were circumcised and found to be negative later and circumcision protected them. Circumcision protects only 56. What he meant is, of all the boys there who came for circumcision, when they did calculation testing first, they found that at least 95 to 99 were still negative. Because those who were positive, they didn't circumcise them, they referred them. Others were not circumcised because of other anatomical problems. You don't circumcise a male when you see they've got an anatomical problem on their males. So our traditional circumcision usually doesn't recognize that. That's why there are usually mutilations and all that. Next. I've already showed you the statistics about HIV. Let me leave that. Yes. We are targeting the ages of 15 to 49 years. We believe that's where the problem is. And I said 2.5 million men by 2015. By the end of this financial year, KZN wants to have reached 187,000. I'm not sure whether they will reach that because the financial year is about to end. But with camps, they can. Next. So I already said there are two methods. Conventional, forceps-guided, and device. In this type, there are a Tara clamp. Dr. Bogus, how many other devices are there, by the way? There are about 8. About 10 different devices. This is just one of them. You can choose any one of those 10. But the World Health Organization doesn't have any policy to tell you which one to choose. Next. The institutions where this circumcision is done are all those. Academic hospitals, regional, district, camps, FET colleges, schools, universities, prisons, private sector. We all do it in those institutions. Next. And who are the people involved? This now. If one of the clamps becomes successful, whether the Tara clamp or whatever, in countries where they are using it, especially Malaysia, they train nurses, just senior nurses. Many, if you have to circumcise 2.5 million people by 2015, it can be done by doctors only. And now it's difficult for nurses to use the dorsal method, but with the clamp, many senior nurses can learn it within a short space of time, and they start doing the clamping. And these are our critical partners. Amakhosi and the socio-cultural experts, these are very important. Parents and guardians, the government and other non-governmental organizations come on HIV counseling testing. This one come on culture and the responsibilities of malehood. Next, this is the report. To date, 18,000 presented themselves and 17,690 were circumcised. I told you about the negative status. That negative means before the circumcision. These are the number of the percentage of people, 0.5, who are not circumcised, because they are either there was no parental consent, or they had penile deformities. That's where anatomy comes in, or they were HIV positive. Those who were HIV positive were cancelled, and they were referred for further management before circumcision. That's why we didn't circumcise all 18. The biggest area where the circumcision took place in large numbers, as you can see, is Mgungundlovu. On my map, it is red. So it is good that in the area where it's red, people are aware and they take action. And then Itekwini also is followed. On my map, it's also red. The other red area on my map is Ugu, but it's a small population anyway. But this is what's happening in KZN. From April up to now when we are reporting, up to date. Next. The social mobilization in this campaign, there's cultural rationale, there's improvement of access to service, there's decongestion of the existing health services because people go into camps. Next. I've already referred to mobilization of traditional leaders and information and education. Next. Next. Just what's happening there. Next. Post-operative care. Next. Our recommendations. Partnership is critical. The strong recommendation is that we must lower the age from 15 years to 12 years. In fact, some people believe the government must come with a policy of circumcising every child born in hospital before they go home, just like other religious groups or cultural groups are doing so, the Jews, the Muslims, etc. There's a feeling that we might have to reach that policy. We believe we are heading towards there, but first we must deal with the adults who are already there. At any rate, it is very painful to be circumcised when you're already an adult. Much, much less painful for babies. Much, much less painful. But for adults, it's really a problem. We also want to do a retrospective study to look at this. Next. Conclusion. KZN achieved 17, they did 17,000 males. How many by those of sleep? No, those were done by normal physical method.
It's 17,000 minus 5,000.
Yes. 12,000, they used an ordinary physical method. 5,000, that's where they used this paraclam, for which I believe you called me here for. Now, out of that 5,000, we had no death, no mutilation, no side effect that required corrective surgery or hospitalization, hospitalization about pain, etc. Now, this war we see about, some people have even posted on the internet pictures of males who were done with this clamp who are supposed to be having side effects. Look, this study is done by professionals. Some of the people who created this, I want South Africa to follow science. If I was not following science in the department, lots of things could have gone wrong. And when there was this war about ARVs and side effects, and people were saying I'm taking sides with the TAC, I was not taking sides with anybody, I'm just following science. What is science saying? What are clinicians saying? What are experts saying? This must guide us. On this issue of circumcision, let's follow and correct the same procedure. These stories we see in the papers that know the owner of the clamp was associated with ANC in exile. The owner of the clamp is a drug baron who was selling drugs. It mixes South African life in the fight against HIV AIDS. There are always things which we put in the way of resolving this disease. If we have got problems, let's follow science. If the problem is about procurement, let's follow procurement laws which you have got. You have got all the right to go there. I heard stories, very wild stories, that some politicians tend to gain from Taratlem. I don't know about that. You have got all the powers to investigate, but let's not discourage this process of circumcision. It will save the nation. It's very important. Those maps are a clear indication of what circumcision can do to our country. And we used to thank His Majesty for delivering, helping us to deliver on this Monday. Thank you. I think that's finished. Thanks.
Yeah, you. Thanks very much, Minister, for this very elaborative and interesting presentation that you have just made. That means that as the select committee, we will be able to explain, defend and educate those issues when we communicate with our communities, because we had little information about them, but now we have made us understand deeper and much better. We'll be able to do those things.
and the medical male circumcision program is also very enlightening and very interesting. The question that I would like to pose is that in provinces such as Eastern Cape, because in most cases there are always deaths when chiefs go to Entabeng all the time, which areas do you think can be recommended or suggested in Eastern Cape so that we deal with the issues of mutilation and death in Entabeng? Yes. And I think I also support the study that you want to conduct on the circumcision of children when they are still babies. I really support that kind of a study. And at this stage, I'm going to allow members to ask questions.
Can I just?
Okay. Yeah, Chairperson, this also raises questions. In this war of the so-called Tarat Lamb, or the Tarat Lamb, people have targeted KZN. There's been no death there, no mutilation, nothing. But where there is death and mutilation, I don't hear people talking and saying, let's stop this. It's quite funny what the war is all about. We never had any death there. Side effects, yes, will always be there. I've done many circumcisions in my life. Even with the dorsal method, there will be people who come back. In fact, we instruct them, when you feel something, please rush back to hospital. Because they'll feel it. You can have massive swelling there, which needs to be dealt with. But we never experienced that on a large scale. But we're saying the results will come out. That is the study that's been done. So we are asking, in the Eastern Cape, we want to negotiate and leaders will help us. That we can't stop traditional circumcision, but can they work with medical staff like they do in KZN to save lives? That's all we're asking for. Let the tradition go on, but let the actual surgical method be done with the help of medical professional staff. That is our plea. We're not asking for any other change. We can't banish. In Limpopo, where I come from, we also know that it's a very well-established tradition. We don't want to banish it, but we're saying, can we work together? And that's, you know, HIV AIDS, after all, is changing traditions. Some people stick to tradition like, but you know, traditions evolve. And that's why the king said, if this tradition we're following for 200 years, if it's killing people, then what's the use? Let's change it. That's all he said. Now the study, Chairperson, I just want to correct. We're not doing the study about children. That one we don't need to study. We know the Muslim religion, they already do that within 3 days, the Jews. It needs no study that's been happening over the ages. All we're saying is, should it be government policy for everybody because of this problem? That's need a study. The study we are doing is the devices. Whether if you use a device, it's cheaper and faster than when you use ordinary surgical method. That's why with ordinary surgical method, they did 12,000. And with the device, they did 5,000. They want to compare. Now, it so happened that in KZN, out of the 10 devices, they chose the Tarat Lamb. Because that's the one they know about. If they can choose any other device, I'll be happy because this one seems to be causing war. But people must tell me first where the war comes from. But any other device with your study, and the World Health Organization was encouraging us that this is the protocol, and they wrote it to us, go and use this protocol, then we'll have, then South Africa will be the first country which comes with, you know, professional study about medical male circumcision using the dorsal method and the Tarat Lamb or any other lamb, and the urologists will help us and tell us whether this is working or not. I know also in the Eastern Cape, the Tarat Lamb has been used for quite a long time, long before KZN even dreamt about it. They've been using it, and there was nobody raised the issue. That's why I want to know whether the issues are political, whether we're raising a political question here or a business one, as it's been said, or what is that which we're dealing with? So the studies about that, but the issue of children is just one day will arrive. We believe if we do it now, we'll be overwhelmed by the numbers, so it's one thing at a time. I'm sure we'll arrive there at one stage. I personally favor that policy, but provided society allows it.
Thanks so much. Let me start with Honorable Ranto, Honorable Mube, Honorable Mashodi, Honorable De Villiers, Honorable Mahate, Honorable Blagi. I don't know whether I should give Faba now. You did ask this question. Okay, you're the last one, Honorable Faba.
Thanks, Chairperson. Chairperson, I've got a few questions right through the presentation. The minister has alluded on a public strike first and said it was an unfortunate thing that happened then. But minister, did you establish during the strike how many deaths were in our hospitals? The overall number. I don't mean it to be tabulated as provinces, but and did the department maybe do something or consult the families in any way, or was it entirely left to the union to do the to go and apologize because of their work or of the strike? The second one is about the volunteers that were working during the strike in this hospital. Will the department recognize them in future for volunteering in the hospitals? Because our hospitals, everybody knows that we've got few nurses, few assistant people to assist in hospitals. For the shortage of the hospitals, will the department in future recognize those volunteers that were working during strike? Also, in those hospitals where there were child mortalities, what measures are taken by the department in specifically in those hospitals? Because for me, I think the department should, when whatever measure should be taken or whatever training is needed, it should start in those hospitals that were affected. Point of suggestion, maybe this one. Also, the minister talked about the centralization of all these people that are working in these NGOs and under certain departments. I think amongst them there should be also those who are specifically trained for pregnant women and to teach those women about prevention that they should take and follow during the pregnancy. That's a suggestion that I am making, Chairperson. Also, in the hospitals or in South Africa, there are people who are coming from other countries. I'm not being xenophobic here. I know I've got a few attitudes towards a small attitude towards the people from other countries. Are they also counted in the statistics of South Africa? Amongst those statistics that among the HIVs, or how do you deal with them? Because they come here and some of them are already infected and they are using this hospital as a place for them to get help. Also, I think this is the last one, Chairperson. Is it necessary for the doctors or those clinical people to use the clamp in the hospital, in the schools, as they are returned here, those this clamp is being used? Can't you take the clamp to the Tara clamp or whatever device to Eshatin in Zambi and use it there, or is it because of the infections that will crop up? Maybe that's why you are using it, Ellen, because there's an attitude amongst these gentlemen or these young gentlemen. If you've done it in hospital, it looks as if you are not a man. It's better that it is done in the field, in traditional places. Thanks, Chairperson.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. Our Chairperson, our that aside from the question that Honorable Ranto asked, to say she was asking to say how many deaths during the strike. Mine would be on the other angle to say, did you notice the increase during the strike? Because even if there are no strikes, there are deaths. So was it more prevalent at that time, or we just exaggerated? On the mortality, child mortality, in relation to Matreke and Nadaspek, Charlotte Matlege and Nadas Street in Gauteng, where I come from, to say at that time there were two messages. Nobody should be blamed, no fault of the personnel. And then as I go to the findings of the task team, the gastrointestinals, and then the overcrowding of the neonatal unit, ratio of the nurse patient, and the adherence to general infection control prevention. To say, since there was that public pronouncement by the Premier and the MC here, to say there was that fault of the personnel, and these findings have never been put into public to say, it's the capacity of the hospital and other things that overcrowding and all those things, so that it. Yeah, I'm saying the findings were not profiled as the allegation at that time. Just responding promptly to say this is the cause. On the mortality due to the HIV infection and the problem starting to escalate from the 90s, and it's now 2010, the lessons that you are learning, I'm not sure whether it is the question of the problem of the access to the nevirapine, maybe from province to province.
Yes.
With a child that took to prevent mother to child infection. Is it the problem of the capacity of the system to say maybe in province A the it's not ARVs are not unless available to prevent, or it's a question of the mothers going very late to the clinics and their status lately detected. The lessons that we I think we're learning from France, as we're saying, the low rate of child mortality in France. So what are the lessons that you are borrowing from France, so that we can then be able to alleviate or lessen this problem? With the strike also, you mentioned the 1976, the 80s. But I think what has been there is that maybe at that time nurses were not unionized. Now they're highly unionized. There's Hospesan, hospitals organizing nurses, there's the HAO, there's DINOSA, all of them organizing there. And there's a right to belong. But there's this question in terms of negotiating the service level agreement. Is there any process to speed up that process so that next year come the wage negotiations, we're not falling into the same trap to say we haven't determined the service level agreement in terms of who must not go or who must go. And the lastly, we've seen the areas in terms of highly challenged on the HIV infection. And at where I come from, it's Egoruleni, Joburg region, and others. Harsimbange and whatever. We hear about KZN intervention through His Majesty. And the launch of the Know Your Status at Egoruleni. Over and above that launch, is there any forecast intervention coming from these areas where there's high prevalence of HIV infection? Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. My first question, Chair, is on page 4, under public strike at KZN. I'll read only the last sentence. Car of staff members banned. One nurse is assaulted. I just want to check, Minister, what action taking place by that time. The second question is on page 7. Minister and staff from the NDOH supported Chris Hani as well as George Mukara Hospital, 60 doctors, nurses, and pharmacists from the NDOH. I just want to check, Minister, all of them are registered. And my third question on the issue of ambulance. Minister, I'm coming from the Free State. My region is KZN-Dabi. There's an area in the Free State by the name of Edenville. That area is between Kroonstad and Hillbrow. It's a rural area. You know, Minister, it's painful because, firstly, we doesn't have a doctor in that area. We doesn't have an ambulance. We have only one clinic. Shortage of nurses. If you want to go to the doctor, we're supposed to travel 47 kilometers. And the population of the people staying in that town, most of them are unemployed. We're supposed to travel 47 kilometers to go see the doctor. When we call the ambulance, our ambulance is coming from Tukuluwa in Hillbrow. We're going to wait until 3 hours. Really, I make a appeal because it's the area that I'm coming from. Minister, if you can assist us, because really it's bad. Thank you. Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. First, I want to thank and speak out, our appreciation to the department under the leadership of the Minister and also all the workers who assist the department in the period of the striking of the personnel. Thank you very much, especially also for the army personnel. I don't think, maybe it's somewhere here, but I don't think that it is in this report mentioned about the army personnel. Because I saw that on television. I was very much interested in the strike. Now, one of my questions...
What about the army personnel?
The army personnel who assisted in the hospital, to help during the strike. My first question is a concern about the strike action. We all know, and also from previous experience before 94, that any strike do have a detrimental effect on community. Now, my concern is actually that why don't the department or government walk that extra mile with the unions to prevent the strike? What was actually the problem that situation wasn't available there to prevent the strike? And then my second question, Chairperson, is from the education department, they were telling us that in the different schools, there are some people who are actually together with the unions, and the information of the strikers, they didn't get that. Do the department also have that problem in the hospitals? If so, what is the information about that? Because I'm actually worried about the correctness of the register of personnel who actually take part in the strike action. Then, in connection with the Western Cape, there was 1% of staff, and then one day 2%. Now, what actually led to this situation in the Western Cape that so less personnel take part in the strike action, so that we can take those examples maybe in future to try to implement that same situation in other provinces. It is not that I'm from the Western Cape, but I think in all different government situations and all the provinces, there are very good examples which we can make use of to help us in solving and also regulate these problems. Then, Madam Chairperson, on page 6, there's only information about Gauteng, but I'm actually asking the department what is the reason that we don't have the information here in this report about the other provinces. That is short. And then the other question my colleague next to me asked, that one, that is the doctors and pharmacists and nurses from the NDOH, the National Department of Health. The other question is on page 9, about the reconstruction of the primary health care. Are you as department busy with a program to reconstruct the situation? What is the progress of that, and who's actually included, who's the role players with you to try to reconstruct the primary healthcare? Just a short information about that. And then about the 700,000 children are born HIV AIDS. 70,000. What is the number of deaths in that 70,000 children? On page 10, Madam Chairperson, there's a downtrend on that map there, graphic, especially between 2005 and 2008. Can the department just give us the information why that such a situation is there on that situation, the HIV prevalence epidemic?
Between what?
Page 20, between 2005 and 2008.
Yes,
there's a downtrend. And then in the success rate in the Western Cape about the HIV prevalence distribution. Now, I know that because I was in the province under the leadership of the ANC in the province, and they actually implemented the giving of medicine, what do you call that, entry retroviral, to children. And in that provincial parliament, we actually did have a very in-depth discussion about that. And the Western Cape government, under the leadership of the ANC, decided to do that. Can the department tell us, is that actually the reason why in the Western Cape the percentage, distribution among antenatal women in the Western Cape, is that situation on that map there. And then I want to go to the circumcision. That will be my last question. I think there's three or four. Three, Madam Chairperson.
One for now.
Just one.
It's a nine.
I'm working, Minister. I'm working.
I'm working.
About the weight of the babies. Why don't, or maybe the department and the doctors do have that situation, why don't we, while the mothers are actually pregnant, during that pregnancy time, that we must try to find out what is the weight and the growth of the baby inside the mothers, so that we can maybe prevent those babies weighing in at birth, say 1 kilogram. That is one of my questions. But I can't come now to the... I will use it. Yes, I will use it. Especially the circumcision.
Thank you, Chairperson. Firstly, let me thank the Minister for the presentation. And before I pose my question, Minister, on page 19... On a lighter note, when I was looking at that picture, that small boy next to the grave, I said, oh, what a child abuse. But it was just on a lighter note. Chairperson, I know that the presentation gives us the national perspective, but maybe I just want to check under the input of public sector strike, that one doesn't get a picture, in particular from the Northwest Province, around the big areas. Because if you look, the hospitals that have been listed here, it's just small areas. The small areas, when you talk about your Delray, it's just a very small area. Bloemhof is very small, and I was asking myself that Bloemhof, even before the public this strike, it once had this destruction because of the political situation there. So I was just asking myself, was it mentioned because of that situation? But one would like to know around the issue of your Bojana, like the hospital there, because of the population, and your Dr. KK, because those are the big areas and big hospitals that were actually what happened, because it's not even mentioned here. Also, if I have to relate that around the issue of the big areas, is the issue of the HIV prevalence, because on page 13, it indicates that when you talk about Bojanala and Dr. KK, it also sent a picture that these are big areas. And one also, it can be because of these are the mining areas. For example, in Dr. KK, we used to have many mining areas, which some of them are closed down. That is why I just want to have a picture around the big areas, actually what was the impact of the strike in those areas. Chairperson, the other thing, I was listening to an interview around these doctors from Israel, Israel doctors with this program or workshop that they had around the circumcision. One was more interested that the minister maybe might touch on that, because when one was listening to the interview, the doctors were very positive around that workshop, which one would be more interested. Also, the issue of circumcision, like the minister rightfully indicated, that education is very crucial, but we seem in most cases when we talk about circumcision, we seem to be focusing
particularly in the rural areas, your KwaZulu-Natal, your Eastern Cape, whereas we do have challenges in the township, particularly where I come from towards December. And you find that mostly this thing is done for commercial interest. I think still we still have to focus in those areas around the issue of education and all that. Lastly, I think this one is just a comment that around the deaths between the age of the youth, if I have to put it, Minister, really is a concern, because even in our constituencies, you ask yourself what is happening, because almost every weekend when it's a burial, obviously you know that a young person has been buried. It means really we still have a long way to go or lot of work before us. Last chapter, I was just like, you know, Freiburg is Freiburg, it's not Freiburg. I'm from the Northwest. It should be corrected. It's one of the big hospitals in Dr. Ruth, Ruth Mompati region. Thank you.
I thank you very much, Chair. And Minister, I must first appreciate your presentation. It was insightful. And I just want to, I'm not going to go to the first part of your presentation on strike, but I want you to clarify me on, particularly on that side, on what is termed essential services. Because half the time it's misconstrued by employees and public to say what it does it mean. If you say and people who are in the health services are actually essential, they are doing essential services, whether they should go on strike, at what time and how, and maybe Minister Feder to clarify me if there is an understanding or memorandum of understanding with the unions to understand exactly what essential services means, and we have a sunset clause on essential services with the union to understand what is their role and how to do it. And the second question, maybe Minister, you have indicated in the report here that South Africa is one of the 12 countries in the world with the highest child mortality rate. I just want to check, Minister, I know we have also, in your report, also identified the problem.
Just before you continue, let me correct, because there will be a mistake. It's not that we have got the highest in the world.
It's part of
it. No, it is. Other countries were able to reduce it, wherever it was. We failed to do so. In other words, we are talking about, we might have been lower than some other countries, but that country was able to reduce. Those 12 countries that I've mentioned in South Africa did not reduce. In fact, it went, it started increasing. That's the difference. I just wanted that to be clear.
Yes. My question is, I wanted to go there. Is there no quicker method or intervention to drastically normalize this state of affairs? That's what I wanted to check with the minister, to make sure that at least we go out of that 12 countries. And lastly, it's on primary health care, Minister. I know you're passionate about primary health care. I've seen a number of meetings since I came here that you're talking about it and changing it and changing the attitude of the people to support you on the issue on primary health care against this curative health system. So I want to check with the minister, that can't we, the minister, run an advocacy campaign to popularize this new thinking about, I know it's been a long practice, but they've died, about the primary health care, and then Minister Feder to deal decisively as ministry managers in hospitals with the attitudinal problem that we see in these primary health centers. Because why I'm saying it, I will make just one example. On this Sunday, one of my friends got injured in a football we took him to a nearby hospital in town. He was broke the ankle, but he was kept there until for 6 hours. We told there's no doctor, the nurses were just waiting and discussing among themselves, and we end up calling a private doctor, took him to the private doctor with the car. So that attitude of our people just sitting there, not responding to the problem that all the kids that is bringing to them. Can't we have some intervention and make sure that it's been changed? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I was not protected by my chairperson previously, I need to explain myself first. Yes. First, I represent the Northern Cape. That's how I've introduced myself, Madam Chair. I'm not representing a political party, so I felt that you should have protected me when the Minister talked about my political party in the Western Cape, as I am representing my province. So just to make it clear for everyone here. I'm not representing a political party, as the minister should also represent government and not a political party here. Now, yes. Thank you, Mr. Minister. Now, as I'm not allowed to ask questions, luckily my colleague here asked a lot of questions. But, yes, Mr. Minister, I'm very concerned about the rising figures on HIV. And I really hope that we can beat this disease. And I must say that I am very, very glad about the King's decision in KwaZulu-Natal to take the decision on circumcision, as I really, in my heart, believe that that's, if I look at what you've showed us, that that might be a solution in decreasing this disease. I must also, just as I'm not going to ask any questions, just clear the air that I won't be part of your 997 list, as I'm already sorted out long time ago. Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Chair, and thanks, Minister, for the presentation. Maybe one has to confess that they go from one province. Honorable Minister, I've got two or three questions here. The first one is in relation with the 51 strikers who invaded the hospital. That is in page 4 of your presentation. And then they got arrested. Now my question is, what will happen after maybe the court shall have found them guilty as you know, employees of the department? I just want to know whether there will be further actions from the part of the department on these employees. The second question is in relation with the strike itself. Are we going to, Minister, continue to experience this kind of action? If the answer will be no, what are the future plans not to experience this kind of strikes? Because to me, this strike has dented the image of government. It has dented the image of government. So that is why I'm asking this question. What are the future plans? Which, indeed, probably next year, during the same period, are we going to experience this kind of action? Or there are indeed concrete plans that will assist to avoid this kind of a strike? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mashamaite. Just to add on the last point that you have raised on the concrete plans to avert the public strike, what I also want to check with you, Minister, is the mitigating the negative effects of the public strike in future, whether there are any plans to try to do that, so that the protection of health workers, the protection of patients is also considered in this process. The other issue is the doctors' salary packages or OSD. Has this process been completed so that we don't find ourselves in the same situation like last year? And you refer to the integration of home-based caregivers, the DOTs, the community health workers. What I want to know is whether, because I know some of them are appointed through NGOs, and they get their salaries through NGOs. How are you going to do the integration process in this regard? Are you going to take them over to the department, or what's going to happen in this case? And lastly, is to thank the minister for the invitation for the National Health Forum on Friday. The committee will send somebody to participate. Thursday, yes. To participate in that forum, we also request your office to also to invite us to other activities. Because I heard about the one that was taking place in Durban, the workshop, but we never gave any get any invitation to that regard. Thanks very much.
Okay, thanks. Thanks a lot, Chet. There are lots and lots of questions. Some of them related. I will try my best because I'm already late for my next meeting with other ministers on very important issues about this very issue of HIV/AIDS. Chairperson, this issue has been asked several times. Of the first question about the deaths during the strike, this issue was debated in the National Assembly, where people want clear numbers, etc. This is a very, very complex issue. Very complex. You see, when somebody dies, to determine exactly what causes the death, it's a very complex issue. It's not something that where you can just stand up and say this person died because of the strike. Precisely because people die every day in hospitals, others have got chronic disease. For instance, if somebody has got a stroke, very severe stroke, at one stage or the other they pass out. You don't know when. If there's a strike, would you say if there was no strike, they would have lived one more? It's a very complex, it needs very deep inquest. Even doctors will never be sure. On the contrary, the second question, yes, about whether you ask it the other way around, about rising mortality. The hospital with the highest mortality because of its size, 2,800 beds, is Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital. On any one day, they experienced 30 deaths. During the strike, the number went down from 15 to 17. It reduced because people were not coming because they had that, you know. So whether if they died at home, then you'll have to determine whether this one died at home because there was a strike. You know, it's complex. If you have got people who have been suffering from HIV and AIDS, who come with a CD4 count of less than 10, and they arrive in the hospital and find nobody and they die, then you must determine that actually the strike that killed them. And it's very complex. I remember in the 80s, there was a very big case where a teacher, during that time there was corporal punishment, applied corporal punishment on a child, on the buttocks, and the child died. It was a school kid, and he died during that corporal punishment. And they did a post-mortem and found that it was a very aneurysm. And aneurysm is a weak part in the vessels which balloons, you know. And then there were big arguments from lawyers. Aneurysm do burst when the blood pressure went high. That no, the kid's blood pressure went high during, yes, but it could have gone high any time because aneurysm burst any time, even when there's no. Yes, so can you know, to prove it and say it's because of that, or whether it just happened to be happening during that or what. These are very difficult questions to deal with. That's why it's not very easy for us to give precise numbers about the deaths during the strike, etc. The one way which would have been very clear to determine was that one where some of the health workers found doctors performing an operation and dragged the nurses out. If that patient died, clearly even in the highest court of law you would have said the strike has caused it. Because when they drag you out, when you put under somebody anesthesia, they say, please, let this person die. But fortunately, as you know, the doctors stood their ground. They said, no ways, we can't leave this patient. The anesthetist and the doctors stood their ground. It is the nurse who was dragged out, but they phoned another nurse who came in, and that person lived. That one clear. Secondly, that nurse who was hit with a brick, if she died, it was clearly because of the strike, because he was hit by strikers. Unfortunately, police didn't catch them. The other cases is very difficult to determine, as I said. But if you want to know whether mortality raised during the strike, no, it actually fell. Because the number of people who were coming, they were not just coming. I mean, I've got these figures from Swiss Hand, where we get the highest mortality. The volunteers, whether we will recognize them, very difficult because, you know, in South Africa, the word volunteer has got a different meaning. I was in education where you find teachers teaching as volunteers. When you arrive as an MEC, they say, hey, I'm volunteering. When are you going to pay us? And I said, but the word volunteer, in the dictionary, it means, you know, so we will try because, but to determine volunteers as a criteria for hiring might also cause problems. Because you have to advertise that post and give the criteria. Maybe they must meet them, but maybe people who are cleaning, etc. If you want nurses, doctors, etc., you really want particular skills. This issue of measures which are taking up in hospitals where there's high mortality, we are doing these measures everywhere. You see, it will be wrong to say because in those hospitals, and that's why I was giving you these figures. Generally about how to deal with infant mortality. What I find with the president, the outcome, was to bring down infant mortality in the whole country. And there are a whole lot of activities that I signed for there. Prevention of mother-to-child transmission, massive immunization, primary health care from school levels, primary health care in communities, etc., etc. It's quite a number of issues. That will also include, by the way, clean running water. Diarrhea, gastroenteritis, where we say these kids were killed by norovirus. In the world, especially in the developing countries, it causes 5 million deaths per annum. That's well low. Things like breastfeeding. For instance, the biggest question is, they are mentioning bottle feeding here in South Matlake. That should not be happening. We have just passed a resolution in the World Health Assembly. Survival of kids rests on breastfeeding. That's a big survival strategy, and when I mentioned it, some people thought I was over-exaggerating. When I was at medical school, they taught us a simple formula called GOBFFF. G-O-B-I, GOBI, then triple F. It's a child survival strategy. It means growth monitoring, oral rehydration. When kids get diarrhea, give them oral rehydration before they reach hospital. Breastfeeding, immunization. If you do growth monitoring, oral rehydration, breastfeeding, immunization, then the triple F is female education, family planning, and food supplementation. If you put up those strategies, you ensure child survival. But these strategies will work if there's primary health care from communities. It can't work from hospital. Because the hospital people already come when it's late. GOBFF must work within communities. That's why primary health care is so important for IME. It's mentioned internationally as clear child survival strategies. But do you know how many children in our country, how many mothers are refusing to give breastfeeding? Especially because of high HIV AIDS rate. Every people, even educated people, believe because of the high HIV AIDS infection rate, HIV positive mothers must never breastfeed. That's what everybody else believes. But all our studies show that it's actually better for the child to breastfeed. That's why in hospitals like King Edward, they even resort to boiling breast milk of positive mothers. Because if you don't breastfeed the child because the mother is HIV positive, they might survive HIV, but they will definitely be killed by other diseases. Which were killing babies long before HIV, that's a fact. That's why in Brazil, they've got a breast milk bank. And we saw it and we wanted to. It must come here to South Africa. Breast milk bank. People know about the blood bank, where you need blood to go to the blood bank.
Mm-hmm.
What about breast milk bank, where women go there to donate their milk, so that children from HIV-positive mothers or those who mothers died can be breastfed? In fact, if you look at these people, believe I'm rude. Human beings in this modern world suffer more than animals, because all the animals are breastfed. Nobody ever met a young lion or a cow or what, eating grass and all that. You have never seen that anywhere in the world. Never. You have never seen any cow, any calf, if I put it, eating grass very early. It's human beings who do that. And the question is, they believe this milk breast milk substitute is the best. It definitely is not. Believe you me, that milk, which is manufactured in factories, etc., is from cow. It's cow milk. God did not make cow milk for human beings. That's why he gave women breast, you know. Yes. So it's very important, breastfeeding. We're going to run a campaign about this. So those are the I was just giving you the program that we are going to run. We've already, the one on I in Gobi SFF, we've already started. In February, this April, we immunized 15 million kids against measles and 5 million against polio. Next year, I want to start a new program against rotavirus, which is the commonest killer in diarrhea. Massive. And pneumococcus, which causes pneumonia and meningitis, etc. We need massive immunization campaigns on the other. We'll satisfy the F. Breastfeeding, yes. And then this female education. Massive female education for them to know. Because many rural women believe, no, when I breastfeed my child, I'm not sophisticated.
Yeah.
That's what saves babies in the world. And I'll tell you why also these kids in Charlotte Mackenzie suffer too on breast milk. You see, at all times when you give children breast milk, even if certainly you need a lot of hygiene, which is not very easy. You need sterilization, which many women cannot do. But secondly, this milk substitute from cows, which you buy in the shops, is irritating to the child's tongue. That's why it's so easy to get diarrhea. And any small virus that comes in gets absorbed, because it's always inflamed. Because it was not made for them. It's very hard, because, I mean, you know, people eat mara mohodu. Have you seen the mohodu of a cow inside? It's very rough. Yes. There's no baby who has got that roughness. But you take that cow's milk and put it down their throat, they are going to get inflamed. It's very hard for them. It's hard. But people who sell these things won't say. So the World Health Organization just took a decision that we need to start running campaign in every country to minimize this, so that, in fact, some believe a woman must only go on breast milk substitute if prescribed by a doctor. Otherwise, ordinarily, must be breast milk. Centralization of community health workers. Yes, that's what we want to do. Let me in short explain to you. I took all the MECs to Brazil. Brazil reduced their infant mortality drastically over a period of 20 years to 19. Ours is 104. 19 children who died per 1,000. One of the things they did is primary health care. That's the movement we want to start. What do? They put up 80,000 teams. We already have 65,000 people. I'm talking about teams. The central test, that each team is headed by a doctor. Where you don't find a doctor is a nurse. Then there's a social worker and all that. But the central person in that team who's always there is called the community health agent. This person is selected by the community, hired by government, and trained by government, and given a certain number of families. They say, these are yours. In that family, the person starts by taking an audit that in this family, there's a young girl, teenage pregnancy, she's on contraception, she's going to school, apply for child support grant. In this one, there's an old man, blood pressure, she's taking treatment here. You know, they all register them in the nearest clinic. So at any one time, each of the community has patients. No, if it's given 500 families, they know everything that is happening in that 500 families. Whether there's HIV, TB, diabetes, they know. They'll tell you immediately. When that person goes to hospital, they know. When he's discharged, the doctors can tell him that we have discharged this person. This is what's happening at home. Whether it's breastfeeding, they'll know. Whether it's taking it, everything. That's the best method we want. Now, we are saying in South Africa, we do have it, but in a haphazard way. These dog supporters, community health workers, they don't record it anywhere. They just do it sporadically at random. Now we're saying we need to coordinate. And yes, of course, it might mean eventually, over many years, because you can't do it at once. I can't hire 6,000 people at once. But many of these NGOs already get money from government anyway. So we like to study. I'm sure I'm in very big trouble in terms of time. Okay. The findings, whether they were made public in Charlotte Market, they were. The NEC called a press conference and announced as to why not earlier. I'm a doctor by profession. I went to Charlotte Market. I saw some of the things on my own, but I didn't want to be presumptive, especially as a minister. I said, let's wait for the experts. Some of the things I saw, they confirmed them, but I said, I can't sit here like an expert and judge myself. Let them come in and tell us. And when I'm saying the health workers, they were just checking, was there anything a doctor or a nurse should have done to stop the death, which they never did. And they found that they did almost everything, but the infection overwhelmed them. The issue of whether the high mortality is because of access to ARVs, etc. Let's know the history of our country. When countries started this treatment, you know, here we started argument. A big debate that ended in the Constitutional Court. That really delayed us, I must tell you. That's why I get very disappointed when we want to start a new debate about circumcision. We come from a bad history of debate in this country where we suspect anything and we suspect everybody and all that. It scares me because it has caused death. And I'm saying we shouldn't do that because it makes us lose about a decade in the fight against HIV. In Brazil, the first fight against HIV, the prevention, started in 1986. That was just 5 years after the first case was announced in the USA. They already started prevention method. The universal treatment, which we started arguing about 10 years ago, they started it in 1996. As early as 1996, they said universal treatment on ARVs in Brazil. Now, they are only dealing with special cases of sex workers, males having sex with males, etc., whereas we are dealing with the general population. In other words, we delayed ourselves by sitting and arguing. That's why I want us to remove this argument in healthcare, please. Let's move on, because we are in trouble more than any country. The issue of negotiating service-level agreements is linked to the last question about what is essential service. You see, this story, because it was put in newspapers and it was made the gospel truth, say, signing a service-level agreement, the government has refused. It's because you can't start there. Firstly, you must start defining. When you say we sign a service-level agreement, it means you have agreed that everybody can go on strike, everywhere, and only those who fall in particular categories will sign a service-level agreement. That you can go on strike, but our agreement is that when you are on strike, this is the service that you offer. In other words, you have already agreed that they will strike. That agreement has not yet been reached. There's still an argument about essential services. You know, it's also in the army. Can a soldier wake up and go on strike? You know, the minister doesn't want it, but the unions are insisting. In other words, if they eventually win, then you sign a service-level agreement. Now there is a big debate. Some say no. Essential services are already defined in the Constitution and labor law. Others are saying no, government needs to sit with union to define what is essential service. It's not yet clear. For instance, if you work in a hospital, anybody working in a hospital, is that an essential service? If you say no, essential service is only nurses and doctors, are you saying then patients can live without food or washing of linen, etc.? These are questions which people are debating. They are not finding solutions, but we rush to the media and put a view, which favors me. When government goes to the media, they'll put a view that favors government. When unions go to it, because these are very serious, intractable questions. Everybody's running around them like this. One day, I'm sure, we'll eventually come to the table. No, nobody wants to face them head on. We are facing them by blaming each other. Like honorable member there said, the stand. The strike dented the image of government. It dented the image of the country, not government. The country, even unions themselves. Because what the world has seen out there is something different from what they saw during the World Cup. And they started asking themselves, what are What type of people are these South Africans? During the World Cup, they welcome everybody. They smile with us. Just when we leave, they start slaughtering each other in their hospitals.
Yeah.
They get very surprised. So it's not only government, it's the whole image of the country. But this issue, I'm telling you, I don't think is being handled in an honest and head-on manner. So that is once and for all. I think I gave a good example about the army. The minister made it very clear. I wouldn't like anybody in the army to be allowed to go on strike under any conditions. And the union said, no, it's our constitutional right. Same thing, I was challenging doctors. Should they choose that? Do they really want this service level agreement as doctors? What about the Hippocratic Oath? Because if you have to go on strike, even if there's a service level agreement, what about the job we've chosen? And the unions like say, no, we are all workers. I deny that. Not everybody is all workers. Because if a miner goes on strike, it's not like when a doctor goes on strike. Not because I'm undermining the miner. If a miner goes on strike, the effect will be the mine owners won't get their profit. Maybe they'll argue that the economy will fall, but immediately that's what will be affected. If it's a doctor, it's immediate death of an innocent person for that matter, not even the mining boss that strikes against. Because I'm arguing here, if you go on strike as a doctor against the government, the person who will die, it's not the government. It's an ordinary poor person. And unions support themselves to be standing for the poor. Because the rich will go to private hospitals, they've got other means of surviving. These are children from working class who will suffer. That's for sure. So this debate needs to be out in the open, where we debate them very soberly, we debate them very honestly and come up with a solution. And not leave it to a particular department and say the minister. It's a societal issue. Not leave it to say, no, the minister must come with solutions. We need each other because it's a societal issue. Like the issue of believing you can attack a nurse when she's going to work. It's a societal issue. Can't be left to a minister of health alone to determine. The focused intervention of HIV/AIDS and area is happening, really. But let me tell you, one of the weaknesses in South Africa, when then after the court case we said we must give ARVs, we started choosing particular hospitals and say they must, their criteria. Those criteria were tough. I've seen them. Many of the criteria, many hospitals will not meet them. Then that's why by February we only have 490 centers providing ARVs. Our aim in this ACT is that by June next year, all 4,000 health centers, that means clinic or hospital, must provide this ACT campaign, for instance. You must be able to move from the street into any area. Yesterday, I visited what I told you at Helen Joseph is the best HIV/AIDS unit in the country, treating 12% of all the HIV-positive people. There are 1.1 million. 12% will be about 135,000. Going to that, it's run between the government and an organization called Right to Care. Their chairperson is a well-known person, Dr. Ali Bagga. You know him from cricket. He's the chairperson of Right to Care. Now, you see, if you look at what they are doing there in terms of the work, follow-up and all that, you realize that they actually know what they are doing. The whole country should be learning from them, including points of health care, etc., etc. And that's why people are rushing there, because they are making a very serious impact. So our focus intervention should be about such areas of access, treatment, etc., which is very important. I think the issue of extra miles is enough. I've dealt with it very well, in a very lengthy explanation. Why did less people in the Western Cape get involved in the strike? You see, if you look at the Lancet report, it doesn't only give that. It gives history. There's a very long, by one of the researchers, Professor Jeru Kovadi, about history. While Western Cape, there are lots of good things that are happening. Let's also know, firstly, why did I say Eastern Cape and Limpopo is surprising? Because when you follow socio-economic indicators, yeah. Limpopo, Eastern Cape, KZN will be the terrible triplet. Whether you're talking about metric results, unemployment, housing, poverty, number of potholes, they are the terrible triplet. They only break rank with HIV and AIDS. The Eastern, Western Cape will always be there. Western Cape has never had a single bandstand. Not a single one.
Yeah.
That one must be known. Mm. Eastern Cape had two. Both of them were independent. That's a double poison. Limpopo has three. One was independent, triple poison. KwaZulu-Natal was having the biggest of them all. Big poison, you know. Now, these things, you must take them into consideration when you follow the history of South Africa and development, because they are reality. Yes. The level of education, etc. Matric results in the Western Cape will always be the highest. They never have to suffer bandit education. They never. If you go to Limpopo, 97% of the people are under bandit education. People talk about Model C schools for sure. In Limpopo, there are only 70 Model C schools. 70 out of 4,000 schools. Everything was bandit education. So if bandit education was a poison that it was, how long do you think it's going to take Limpopo to survive? These are realities. But when people look at these 16 years, they believe we will have changed this thing in a short space of time. It's difficult. So Western Cape has been saved by that in child mortality, female. But of course, they also did the correct things, as the speaker here was saying. Like we know, this prevention of mother-child transmission, they studied it much earlier, and I really praise them for that. Like in the hospitals, most of the managers they hired are very highly qualified. And the correct one, if you go to Limpopo, in Eastern Cape and look at who's a hospital CEO, if you see that list, you're likely to run away. That's something I don't want to see. It's one of the jobs, the main things that we have to change in this country, if healthcare will run normally. So the primary healthcare process, yes, we have started. We have started with the workshops I've told you. And I think most of the questions, yes, the flattening of the graph. Why did that graph flatten? I think when we start the war against HIV, it's giving universal treatment, etc. The prevalence no longer goes. The incidence, in other ways. It's a little bit confusing. There is incidence and prevalence in HIV AIDS. Prevalence is the number of people who are HIV positive at any one time. If you put many people on nevirapine, it goes high. I mean, sorry, on ARVs. Meaning there are many more people who are now HIV positive but surviving. They are not dying. So when you count them, the number of positive people are increasing. Whereas incidence measures new infections. It's a very difficult measure which scientists are still arguing about. So at one stage or the other, there's been a leveling of that prevalence because many more people were, you know, becoming aware, condoms were being distributed and all that and all that. The issue of number of deaths out of these 70,000 children, this is another question that the country will still have to resolve. If you check statistics South Africa, they put HIV AIDS as number one, number nine killer, not number nine, instead of South Africa, all their documents. Number one is TB, then they put their pneumonia, then diabetes is number five, HIV is number nine. You know why? Because they go to Home Affairs to check death certificates. Doctors don't write HIV on a certificate. Number one, because HIV is not necessarily dead. They write the cause of death. HIV is underlining, but you get killed by pneumonia, TB, or something else. That's what they write. But secondly, because we need to change it right from here in Parliament, and I'm arguing many people get angry, until HIV becomes a notifiable disease by law, we won't know. Because doctors will tell you, no, it's not notifiable, they'll sue me. Others will say, look, the family asked me for a favor, the insurance companies refused to pay. It is HIV. Now we are making our people live a lie with the laws we are doing, that if you die for HIV, no insurance must pay. So people must lie to protect their clients. So that statistics of lying goes to studies of that reason, and they capture it as reality and say HIV AIDS is number nine killer, when we know it's number one. There's no question about it. It is number one. Can never be number nine. But you can't blame them because those are the official documents they've got in front of them. So that's why the 70,000, we can't say, all we know is follow that statistics. It says HIV AIDS increases the chance of dying when you are the first 6 months of life 15,000 times or by 1,500%. You can calculate from that. But what we know is the infant mortality. We've got 20,000 children who die. Sorry, 22,000. Who died before they reach the age of one? We have got 20,000 who are not even born, who died before they are born. They're still there, it's 20,000. Those who die before they reach the age of five is 75,000. That South Africa will then tell you that in 2006, 57% were killed by HIV/AIDS. You can calculate from that. But otherwise, to say out of these 70,000, what, how many died? They are going to put many causes of death, pneumonia, gastroenteritis, meningitis, otitis media, etc. So it won't be easy to determine it. The strike around big hospitals in Northwest. You see, Northwest was not very heavily affected also. But it's also because of the reports they gave us. These are the reports they gave us. But it was not very heavily affected by the strike. It was not like Gauteng, KZN, Limpopo, etc. And Eastern Cape. The other issue about Western Cape, the trade unions were not very militant during the strike. They were very mild. I must also mention that. That's another factor. Maybe it's also because of historically. They never had that level of anger, of living in a bandstand, suffering, all these things, you know. So these things add up. No, they do add up. Because if you saw the level of anger of people who believe they've been oppressed for a long time, they add up these things. But in the Western Cape, really, things were relatively normal. The issue of attitude of staff, I've already mentioned how we are going to deal with them. Because we say it all the time. Eventually, you need an instrument. What happened to you, Honorable Plaggy, is if the Office of Standard Compliance was established, you would have gone to the ombudsman. You are going to investigate that clearly to see whether, because some nurses will say, what would you have done? There was no, you know, he wants to, the ombudsman will establish whether this person was a bad attitude or is the condition or what. At the moment, even by you members of parliament, let me tell you, I don't know whether you have noticed that on yourself. Anything that happens in the hospital, you blame the state. The person who is there is the CEO and the workers. They don't feel the pressure. They say, no, government will blame. Even those who are late who don't do their best, they know that government will blame. If kids fail and get 0%, in most cases we say the Minister of Education. Even when we realize that that principal doesn't care, he doesn't go to school, but society don't pile pressure on them. So with this Office of Standard Compliance, one, me, I must take my responsibility as the minister, but the person at the point of care. Yeah. Also for the responsibility, he can't just be all at large. But many of them hide. They know that in the newspapers, nobody will follow them up. Members of parliament, they'll call the minister to account. They say nothing about the CEO, the clinical manager, or individual doctors. And here is one for which I'm very infamous, which is said everywhere in South Africa, everybody believes it. Shortage of staff, shortage of staff, shortage of staff. I'm going to present it on Thursday. During the workshop on quality of healthcare, I showed it. If you compare us with the rest of Africa, we've got more staff than any country in the continent. Yes, the doctors, the nurses, etc. We've got a table, I got that table from the World Health Organization, showing the ratio of nurses to doctors. During the strike of doctors, Rashid, I was praying that doctors are leaving this country, they are angry. They are leaving because we pay them nothing. And everybody believes that, newspapers, everybody, you can't convince them. I went to the World Health Organization, Africa Summit in Kigali. This matter of doctors migrating is an international issue. It's always on the agenda. Now, let me tell you what happened. The Africa region, World Health Organization has got six different regions. I belong to the Africa region. We had our meeting in Kigali. They put this thing on the agenda, preparing for the World Health Assembly, where all the ministers of health in the world meet, because we negotiate this issue. No minister wants to use doctors anywhere in the world. Even in England or America, they don't want to. Nobody wants that. And people believe there are a lot of doctors waiting somewhere just to be deployed. So when it was discussed, it was just after the doctor strike. I was waiting for that to be, that is going to help me. I was shocked. The minister said, before we discuss, let's discuss South Africa. There are a problem in this continent. They steal all our doctors. Yes, South Africa. I said, every country in this continent is suffering because of South Africa. All doctors are migrating there. No, it's not the other way. It's true. It's true. It's absolutely true. We suffer from England and Germany and all that. The Europe, let me not say England, Europe, but England is the most, because they're related to us in language and all that. But funny enough, other countries, for instance, while you believe we are suffering, somebody from Canada made the remark, he said, hey, if it was not for South African doctors, we'll be suffering because America is stealing our doctors. Yes. Canada is suffering from America. It all depends who is richer. So we are the richest in the continent. They come here. That's why within SADC, there is a protocol that South Africa must never recruit a doctor from SADC. It's a protocol signed saying you must never, because you are destroying us. Now, last year I negotiated with them that only those doctors who are inside the country, maybe let me hire them. That's why there was a big story about a long queue. And they say the department is ineffective. It's because you must check. Some of these people, you employ them, you get a phone call from the minister and say, but why are you doing this to me? We agreed at the World Health Organization. So last year, no, this year in May, the World Health Organization debated this issue. It's very difficult. If you look at the agencies of the United Nations, one of them is the World Health Organization. The other is International Labor Organization. International Labor Organization will pass a resolution and say, every worker can sell their labor power anywhere in the world. Anywhere, if you are right, you can go anywhere. Then the World Health Organization will say, no, doctors must not migrate from developing countries to the developed country because they will kill them. Then they have to do a mixture of the two. Please don't recruit from a poorer country. But if you recruit from a rich country, be very careful. Yes, conduct the minister and all that. Some countries write a letter and say, yes, we release that one. We signed a deal with England and say you are richer than us, please don't recruit. They agreed. In March, when I went there with the president during the state visit, I went to the Ministry of Health. They showed that there used to be 1,700 nurses from South Africa. There are now only 72 because they are no longer recruiting them actively because we have agreed that please don't destroy us. Now, don't think I'll just open my eyes and recruit from England as if the minister there will be happy. Because everybody wants to leave their quarter. So it's a very complex international issue we check. And luckily, people here, I saw it when it was in one of the papers blaming us. They seem to be believing that because we have got a shortage in mortalities, we can recruit doctors from anywhere. We can't. Some of them differ. The qualifications differ. A specialist in South Africa is not like a specialist anywhere. You find a person calling themselves a specialist, having trained for 6 years. In South Africa, to be a specialist, you must be trained for a minimum of 12 years because before you have got that title. But in other countries, they come, I once worked with doctors. Let me not mention the name of the country. I don't want the diplomatic route. In a farmland area, there were doctors from that country. I discovered in labor all that these people are disorientated. They don't seem to be knowing any female part here. And I confronted them and said, no, guys, why it looks like the moment you enter the labor ward, you don't seem to be know what you are doing. They confessed, they said, no, in terms of our religion, a man cannot touch a woman. So in my training of medical school, I could never touch a woman. It's never done in my religion. So my training is 4 years. It excludes gynecology and obstetrics. In South Africa, if you don't do obstetric gynecology, you can't work in South Africa. In any rural area, when you go to work in a hospital clinic, it's obstetrics, gynecology, and pediatrics. If you don't know those, forget. Now, people apply for jobs in South Africa with such things. There's noise that now the ministry is not moving. There's a shortage of doctors. You need to employ them. Last week, I got very angry because it was debated in one of the radio stations. Any doctor who comes here from another country must write exams of the Health Professions Council. There's a set exam by specialists who are in that field. That doctor wrote and then went to the radio and wrote a member of parliament here who I should name. That university shouldn't take her. She passed theory, she didn't pass practice. And she's not like in this way. This policy of South Africa, I checked documents. That person wrote and failed 4 times. But then they wrote me a letter and said, because there's high infant mortality, you're killing children if you don't employ me. I must employ a person who has failed. Then they support, the people who are supporting this government is terrible. There are people who are dying. I need to protect this country, people.
Yeah.
And I must protect it even from doctors. Because there are doctors who are very poorly trained. The fact that we have got this mortality this year doesn't mean we are resisting that anybody can come and practice what they want here. We still want standards. And we want quality. And please allow me to check that quality. And please allow me, for instance, even if SADC agreed that doctors who are here, I can hire them. If they are here illegally, do you want me to hire an illegal immigrant as a country? What will happen to our constitution? But many of them rush to political parties and the media and say, I'm here. I know there's a shortage, I'm a doctor. If you came illegally, it will be a very serious embarrassment for us to hire you. So there are criteria that these people must have. Employment permit, they must, you know, home affairs must have come in, must clear. Now, when you clear, that process is long and tedious, but sometimes, or most of the time, they lie to you. Because the person, let me repeat this, will tell you, I'm a specialist. I'm a specialist. And in the country, they've got that title, specialist. When they get here, you get surprised. Specialist in South Africa, guys, it's a very big thing. That man there who calls himself a consultant, before you arrive there, you must sweat. They don't easily just allow that title. But in many countries, it's easy. Take, for instance, MD. All Americans will write, Dr. Aaron Mutualegi, MD. In South Africa, MD is the highest degree you can ever attain in medicine. I know only 5 Africans in the history of this country who have got MD. But people come here with MDs and say, no, I'm a specialist, hire me. It's a different system, so we need to check this system. That's why it's easier with countries which follow the same system as ours. When countries follow different systems of training, hiring doctors and nurses from there is a little bit tricky. And I want members of parliament, please understand that. Because people are pushing us with certificates here. They differ. It's just like me. If I pass my boundaries matric, I can't go to England and show them. No, they'll tell you, yeah, we want all. Yeah, no, it's true. They do that. They do that and say, no, we don't recognize this thing. But why people want us to open South Africa to anybody, it puzzles me, but that's what they seem to be thinking. And over the radio, when they debate, they seem to be thinking like that. If I start opening as they want, believe you me, one day when these people die, kids die, and there's an investigation, I'll be asked. For instance, this doctor who failed 4 times, calling herself a pediatrician, neonatologist, wanting to work for children below the 1 year age. If I say, look, he's a specialist in a country, let me allow her to work because she has worked for 20 years according to a letter in a country, and a child dies, and they found that he failed medical exam for health professional counsel 4 times, I think I'm liable to murder. Yes, I'm liable to murder, very clearly. Yes, I'm necessary to murder because I have somebody who failed. That exam is simple for anybody who must be a doctor. That's what the health professional council said. We called all the specialists to set it and say, they say if a person is at this level, we are happy. And we keep on repeating, it's not that we are very strict. Or SD, if we completed, yes. Contrary to belief, guys, there is this war that MPs earn a lot and doctors, etc. You'll never end anywhere near a professor of medicine now. All professors of medicine, their starting point is at the level of a director general in government. All of them, we put them at that level. All interns are now at the level of an assistant director. Is it assistant or? Yes, deputy director, not even assistant director. That's their starting level. There are people who are deputy directors who have got PhDs and worked for 20 years. But medical students, the moment they pass under OSD, you start working for the first time, you're already at the level of deputy director. We've already implemented that, but people don't seem to be talking about this or seeing it. They keep on talking about the fact that these people are underpaid and all that. We have done that because we want to keep them. So there are professors who at today will be, because 1.3 is an entry, who are at the same level where, you know, 1.4 billion, 1.5, where deputy ministers, some even crunching upon ministers. It's what we have done. But they don't. They don't come out openly and say, yes, this is what has been done. In fact, some of them dodge. We're still going to deal with this issue. He's a professor. He's put at this salary scale of 1.2. Opens a private practice, comes to the public hospital, work for 1 hour and run away to their practice. Some are doing that even at that high level. I had a complaint from the MEC for Health in KZN, where medical students complain that they are not being taught. Because their professors are rushing out to practice in private practice when I'm paying them 1.4 million. And I'm appealing to that profession that they must start thinking morally. Because this loss of morale seems to be anywhere, everywhere in our country. So OSD has been completed. I think I've answered all the questions. Okay. Oh, no, that one, ma'am. That one of lack of ambulance is in your province. clearly poor management there. We'll have to go and look into it.
Please.
I don't know. You know, do you know how many times I sent the late deputy minister of health to Free State and this gentleman? Now, this week, I sent the new deputy minister. I always send people to Free State on money. There's a problem there. You know, I'm trying to assist you. But, you know, I just want you to know that we're trying our best. We keep on sending people there. He went there about 3 times, as a deputy, just to sit there and see what's happening. You know, so we will have to start assisting you. It's true.
Yeah, the minister, our issues of health issues are very close to our hearts, and they are very, very interesting and very exciting. And I think most of the members there are the meetings that they have to attend to now,
me too,
including myself. Can I take this opportunity to thank you very much, Minister, with your team, and also the honorable members for the very relevant and questions and fruitful discussion that they have embarked on to understand much better the issues on this particular matter that we're dealing with. And, yeah, we will meet next time, Minister, when we deal with the annual report. Yes,
Members, who's available for Thursday meeting? Health department? To represent us? No, it's sent to the chairperson, that's why you didn't get it. So, as a chairperson, I'm asking who's available on Thursday. Like it? I'm talking here. Who's available Thursday to represent the committee?
Where?
In Johannesburg. Is it Johannesburg?
At what time?
No, the whole day.
The whole day?
Mm.
Yeah, I can be available because I have to attend a certain hearing on Friday.
Oh, thank you very much.
So it will be my advantage.
Yes, I'll give you all the documentation to that room.
All right, no problem.
Thank you.
No, 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 no,